This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by this podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions represented are our own and not representative of University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
With the start of a new academic year comes new interns, new residents, and this year, new narrators of the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. We'd like to thank our outgoing narrator, creator and founder of the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast, Eddie Chin, for all of his work getting this started.
My name is Casey Smiley, and I'm a second-year resident here at Vanderbilt, and I'm excited to continue some of the traditions that Eddie started.
And my name is Alex Wiles. I'm also a second-year resident, and we hope to bring some new ideas to episodes coming soon. But for now, we'll start off with a format you know well, interviewing our chiefs to hear about the most interesting morning presentations from the last month.
First, you'll be hearing from Brian Grebe, our chief over at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. So one thing you always think about when a patient comes in with a fever is tick-borne illness. I heard that Catherine gave a great talk about tick-borne illnesses, and Brian's here to tell us more about that.
Yeah, Catherine did do a really great presentation. She highlighted some of the epidemiology surrounding tick-borne illnesses. In 2004, there were 22,000 cases that were reported, but this has almost doubled. And in 2014, there were 43,000 cases reported. Lyme disease, it's estimated, accounts for $700 million to $1.3 billion of total cost to our healthcare system annually. Of the six main tick-borne diseases, ehrlichiosis and rocket matted spotted fever are the two that are endemic to the Tennessee area, whereas Lyme disease, babesiosis, and anaplasmosis are more commonly found in the Northeast and North Midwest. Catherine specifically reviewed the pathophysiology of rocket matted spotted fever is distinct from other tick-borne diseases because it infects endothelial cells and causes a very distinctive rickettsial vasculitis. So this is one of the reasons why rocket matted spotted fever has a higher incidence of rash, 50 to 80%, compared to other tick-borne diseases like ehrlichiosis, which has a rash incidence of 33%. Some of the other common presenting symptoms for Rocky Mountain spotted fever are fever, nausea, vomiting, headache, anorexia, and myalgias. And then the lab abnormalities that we're used to seeing, we see thrombocytopenia, hyponatremia, and a mild AST-ALT elevation. The other thing that's distinct about Rocky Mountain spotted fever when compared to the other tick-borne diseases is it has a much higher incidence of fatality, estimated to be 5 to 10%, compared to less than 1% for anaplasma versus 2 to 3% for ehrlichiosis. This is the reason why, even if someone reports a doxycycline allergy, you want to treat them with doxycycline. If you absolutely cannot give doxycycline, the alternative therapy is chloramphenicol. Another side note on tick-borne diseases, Blake Funke actually gave a professor rounds on a case of ehrlichiosis that induced HLH. It was very fascinating. And so as a former hem-onc fellow, I got lots of phone calls by concerned residents who had patients with elevated ferritins that were concerned that those patients had HLH. So one of the things that I often shared with them was the diagnostic criteria for HLH. And so I was just going to review that here. It's eight different criteria, and you have to meet five of those criteria. You have to have a fever, which is very, very sensitive. You have to have splenomegaly, cytopenias affecting at least two to three lineages. Specifically, you have to have a hemoglobin less than 9, platelets less than 100, or neutrophils less than 1,000. So lymphopenia does not count as a cytopenia, and that's a very important distinction. The other two things you can have is you can have hypertriglyceridemia, which is a fasting triglyceride level of greater than 265, or low fibrinogen less than 150. And then you have to have a ferritin greater than 500. So those are some of the non-specialized tests. The other specialized tests is you have to see hemophagocytosis, and typically we would see that on a surgically resected lymph node or on a bone marrow biopsy. And then there are specialized tests that get sent off to the University of Cincinnati Children's Hospital, NK cell activity, or an elevated soluble CD25.
So I know a hot topic in the care of oncology patients is how we treat venous thromboembolism. And I heard that Peter gave us a great talk on all of the new updates coming out. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's correct. Peter Thorin gave a great presentation about VTE in cancer patients. We think of cancer just universally increasing someone's risk of developing a PE, but actually the highest risk of developing venous thromboembolism is associated with pancreatic, ovarian, CNS, and gastric cancer, whereas things like breast and prostate actually carry a pretty low risk of VTE. So he reviewed Virchow's triad, which surrounds patients with thromboembolisms, and that is alteration in blood flow, vascular endothelial injury, and an acquired hypercoagulability, which in this case is being triggered by cancer. So we all know the clotting cascade by heart from medical school, of course, but really all that you're concerned about is the fact that factor 10A activates thrombin, which forms a clot. Antithrombin inhibits this process, and heparin for a long time has been the mainstay of therapy for pulmonary embolisms because it is able to activate antithrombin and inhibit the clotting cascade. What has been a big source of frustration is that oral DOACs have not been validated for use in this cancer population. But there's been some interesting papers that have come out about this, and Peter highlighted this in his presentation. So in February of 2018, the New England Journal of Medicine published a paper comparing edoxaban to low molecular weight heparin. And this was a non-inferiority trial that showed that edoxaban was non-inferior in cancer patients with pulmonary embolisms for, number one, recurrent VTE, and also had a very similar bleeding profile. However, following that, there was the SELECT-D trial, which compared rivaroxaban to low molecular weight heparin. And rivaroxaban actually had a lower incidence of VTE compared to low molecular weight heparin, 4 versus 11%. But had a higher incidence of major bleeding, 4 versus 6%, and a significantly higher incidence of clinically relevant but non-major bleeding, 13% compared to 4%. So I think that this is going to be a continued source of investigation as to whether or not DOACs can be safely used in cancer patients across the board.
I heard that Rebecca gave a great talk about acquired angioedema, something that we don't see all too frequently. Brian, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Dr. Brown actually loved Rebecca Chowdhury's presentation on acquired angioedema. Some of the features of angioedema that we commonly think about is swelling that is asymmetric and non-dependent, usually is pretty rapid in onset, but can occur over a few days. The common places that we think about it happening are in the face, the lips, and the upper airways. And the other place that it can actually happen is in your bowels. So there's several things that can cause angioedema. The thing that we all always think about are ACE inhibitors, but there are other medications such as aspirin and NSAIDs and calcium channel blockers that are known triggers of angioedema. Allergic reactions can also cause angioedema. And then, of course, there's genetic or acquired complement deficiencies. While an allergic reaction is mast cell mediated and due to massive histamine release, acquired or medication-induced angioedema is mediated through bradykinin. High molecular weight kininogen is turned into bradykinin by kallikrein. And the bradykinin binds to the beta-2 receptor and causes localized vasodilation. ACEs degrade bradykinin, and this is one of the reasons why ACE inhibitors are a trigger for angioedema. From a genetic standpoint, C1INH degrades kallikrein, and so if you have a genetic C1INH deficiency, this is another reason why you're predisposed to developing angioedema. In addition to genetic C1INH deficiencies, you can also develop an acquired C1INH deficiency. And there are a variety of reasons why this can happen. So 30 to 40% of the time, this can be associated with lymphoproliferative malignancies, such as B-cell lymphomas. Another third of the time, it's associated with MGUS, or myogammaglobulinopathy of undetermined significance. Another 5 to 10% is autoimmune diseases like lupus. And then another 5% or so is paraneoplastic syndrome from adenocarcinoma. And there's a certain subset that are just idiopathic, and we haven't elucidated those mechanisms yet. If you're working someone up for suspected angioedema, some of the things that you should send are an ESR and a CRP, which would likely be elevated. You can send a C4, which will be low in about 95% of cases. And then if you are worried about an acquired C1 INH deficiency, you can send either a C1 functional assay or look for circulating C1 INH antibodies. So as far as treating angioedema, the number one most important thing is to avoid the triggers. And so for people who have been exposed to ACE inhibitors and that was their trigger, they're going to be off those for the rest of their life. Treating in the moment, though, epinephrine, antihistamines, and steroids, they won't help at all. You have to use something that's going to affect the bradykinin. And so there are plasma-derived concentrates for C1 INH that work very well. And there's also recombinant formulations as well.
Thanks, Brian. That'll do it for this episode. But stay tuned for our next episode with Cases Across the Street with Peter. See you next time.